Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One. It's time for the most epic weekend of the year. Saturday, June 18th, it's the Corolla Family Barbecue 2022. Head over to Corolla Drinks to be the first to get your tickets to the Corolla Family Barbecue. This year, headlined by the band Lit. Your ticket includes booze, barbecue, bands, and of course, time to hang out with the Corolla family, all the lackeys, and some of your favorite friends and comedians on the show. Don't wait to buy tickets to this event, because it will sell out. Wine Case Club members are automatically guaranteed tickets. And if you're in the mood to make a weekend out of it, join Lynette and all your favorite lackeys for the Mangria Bar Crawl Los Angeles the night before the barbecue. All tickets and information can be found online at CorollaDrinks.com.
Geico, do you own, do you rent your home? Well, you do one or the other. You work hard enough. How about you do a little bundle? Bundle with Geico. Make it easy to bundle the homeowners and renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got enough to do. You're busy these days. Save a bunch of money. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save when you visit geico.com and get to bundling.
This is Corolla Digital. This is Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get on. A choice, making our mandate. Get it on. Welcome to the best hour or so in the universe. It's Reasonable Doubt. I'm Adam Carolla. That's Mark Garagus in New York City.
Miami, Florida, but I will have you know that I actually appeared in the Burbank courthouse virtually for a couple hours this morning and was able to do it from Miami. So what's better than that?
What case were you working on?
On the Tinhorn Flats. You know, they had prosecuted poor Lucas, and so finally was able to get that get him judicially diverted, which means that there will be no conviction and it'll obliterate his record. So he's got no record. When having to point out some of the infirmities, I was chuckling to myself the irony that poor Lucas is having to go to the inside of a Burbank courtroom during the supposed Omicron raging out of control to answer charges about his dad having serving food outdoors during the last wave. It just shows you the universe does have a sense of humor.
Well, we can talk about the Supreme Court ruling that's going on, or at least the Supreme Court discussion that's going on as we speak about vaccine mandates. And you know, my first question is how much, because it reminded me of your case with Tinhorn Flats. You know, they had some sort of dubious notions about outdoor spread and outdoor dining and things of that nature. They've all been squashed and disproven, and the intelligent people knew nothing existed before the mandate went down. But one could argue the fog of war, blah, blah, blah. But as it pertains to the vaccine mandates, you know, when the initial vaccine notion was rolled out and the idea was you're going to get vaccinated and then you won't be able to spread it to coworkers. And then some of the people said, well, if you're vaccinated, then what do you care? I mean, isn't that, why are you endangering other people if you're vaccinated? And the science at the time was, well, you'll be vaccinated, but you can't catch COVID and you can't spread COVID. So we need a mandate because this vaccine stops you from spreading it and it stops you from catching it. Well, that was 5 months ago. Now, with the vaccine, you can catch it and you can spread it, which to me makes the it takes the teeth out of the mandate.
I'd add one thing to that. There was, I believe, in yesterday's American Medical, so the AMA Journal was, and Gary, I think I sent it to you, six former advisors to the president came out, all people who previously have kind of adopted what I would consider the first iteration of, we're going to flatten this out, we're going to get rid of this, and, you know, just hold on tight, have now come around and are basically saying it's become evident that vaccine immunities do not hold on or aren't long lasting. Obviously, it's self-evident when you're talking about a booster or a fourth shot, and natural immunity, there, it looks like, wanes as well, as the variant, which makes sense because as variants come along, you would assume that the natural immunity is only good for a certain variant or percentage of variants. And so now they're saying we have to manage. This is the latest. And Gary, you might be able to quote some of it.
Yep, I can read the quote.
Stunning admissions.
Yeah, the quote that Mark highlighted for me said this, quote, "The appropriate risk threshold should reflect peak weekly deaths, hospitalizations, and community prevalence of viral respiratory illnesses during high severity years, such as 2017 to 2018. That year had approximately 41 million symptomatic cases of influenza, 710,000 hospitalizations, and 52,000 deaths."
So, yes.
Yeah. Well, go on, because I knew when I read that, I thought of you and you were, and what your first reaction would be. But let me hear it.
Well, you know, whether it's natural immunity or the variants or the vaccine waning or cloth masks not being effective anymore, like all the stuff they were trying to cram down on everyone for the last 20 months has been basically incorrect. Closing schools down. I love to see everyone do the about face. You know, the same people that were vigorously trying to close school downs are now vigorously explaining, you know, Lori Lightfoot's screaming at the union, you got to reopen the schools. This is an outrage. It's insane how fast people can do an about face on this stuff. But it seems to me like all this stuff sort of helps the case of the people who are fighting the vaccine mandates. So as science changes, the case changes as well, or how say you?
Well, I think that part of what's been reported, you know, there's, I think, going on 3.5 hours today, and this is Friday, of arguments in front of the U.S. Supreme Court case or the U.S. Supreme Court on two different cases on the mandates. One is on the issue of employers with 100 or more is kind of the OSHA question, whether OSHA can impose that. The other one is on the issue of whether if you're receiving federal money, that the feds can then compel you to do it. And so it sounds like, if you're going to read the tea leaves, that the latter one, receiving federal money, may get some traction. But it certainly, reading the tea leaves once again, sounds like in the former case with OSHA that they're going to adopt some of the arguments that have made at the lower courts when they've enjoined that basically this is overreach by OSHA. And then Gary picked out one point of this, that they were asking the questions, and I believe it was either Alito or Kavanaugh.
It was Alito.
Was it Alito? And mind you, if this wasn't a left versus right issue, and you had somebody ask this question, you would say, "Hey, that's a smart question." But you can't say that if you're on the left or the right, because you have to always look at it through your ideological prism. But he asked a question which I thought was pretty good, which is, has there ever been a case where OSHA is mandating something that does have a demonstrable, even though it's not overwhelming, but a demonstrable risk, medical risk? And how do you do that? Which kind of is the reason, obviously, that I perk up over that is that harkens back to, as you mentioned, kind of the County of LA litigation that we did, where the judge was saying you've got to at some point do a cost-benefit analysis. You just can't keep doing what you're doing. I mean, I have said it once, I'll say it 100 times. that the trial court judge in the County of Los Angeles case, again, with the engine company, was prescient. It's his 53 pages, if you read it now, going on, 14 months later, is astonishing, where he laid out all of these things and what the problems were when you just issue these mandates. And by the way, we are now reaching a perpetual state of emergency. I mean, that was even mentioned by these various former Biden health advisors, that we are not going to be able to sustain a perpetual state of emergency. You can't do it. It doesn't have, there's absolutely no basis upon which to do it.
Well, speaking of that, and then first a sidebar, which is when I first heard about this OSHA mandate for companies that had over 100 employees, my first impulse was, oh, man, I feel bad for these companies that have 103 or 104 employees. And then I stopped and I went, no, this is going to be a windfall for them. Because if I had 104 employees, I would go, look, I just get them all in the same room and go, six of you are dead fucking weight. Like, let's be honest. You know who you are. I'm not going to say your name, but I am not going to comply with this. I'm going to get down to 99 employees. So six of you are going to be shit canned. And I suggest everyone up their fucking game over the next few months while I consider this. And I would use this lemon. I would make lemonade out of this. Because it is ultimately going to, it'll have unforeseen consequences or unintended consequences, which is any business that's at, 90 employees and is thinking about expanding to 110 employees is going to go, fuck it, we're stopping at 99. It's interesting, the number 99, because if you do enough theater and enough improv in Los Angeles, you will see many of what they call 99-seat theaters. They're all called, it's a 99-seater. There's no 103-seaters. There's 99-seaters, and then there's 300-seaters. So why is there a bunch of 99-seater theaters in Los Angeles? Equity waiver. If you're under 100 seats, you can do an equity waiver. So, of course, everyone just builds up to that size, and then they stop. So you have no idea what the consequences of some of these mandates are. There's tons of companies that may be thinking about expanding over 100, and they're not going to hire those people if this thing passes. For sure. Why wouldn't? It could go no other way. Where did we get all the 99-seat theaters in Los Angeles? Well,
And that is a cost-benefit analysis. Part of the reason that we are economically where we are is that it's very tough to go backwards. I mean, what people are seeing, I read articles about the great resignations, and I read articles about how it's difficult to get people back to work. And it's, when you're going on 20 months of kind of a conditioning of people that they don't have to be somewhere, and now you're saying, well, this is going to go, and you've been led down that path by various pronouncements that really made no sense at the time. And I also will hearken back to those of you who say, well, that's because the science is evolving. People understood, the health czar of California knew 14 months ago and said it in a flippant remark to a reporter, something to the effect of, we're not really worried about outdoor dining. We just want people to congregate indoors. Well, they knew one half. They knew that there was nothing going on outdoors, but at the same time, they arguably were compounding the situation by getting people to congregate indoors. And by the way, we're now talking, and once again, I invite people to read these op-ed pieces by the various former Biden advisors. These people are now saying, we're not even at an endemic stage at this point. We're still in a pandemic. Well, that's kind of a worrisome thought, isn't it?
Also, out here, our Governor Gavin Newsom extends the Emergency Powers Act every 10 minutes. So he's we're under a constant emergency powers thing, which makes him in power, and he can decree whatever he likes. I think he just did something about the masks on February 15th.
Yep.
The Super Bowl is at SoFi Stadium. I think that's the 14th 13th. Or 13th. So he got 48 hours after that. I think there's some talk about maybe going to Texas. I don't know. What's your thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, you know, this reminds me of the last time they did one of the, he pulled one of these stunts. He waited for another date to put it over pass so that there wouldn't, I think the last time was his recall election that he basically punted until the day after his recall election. So that's, you start to see a pattern here that can make people who are already cynical about politicians or government even more cynical or start to believe some conspiracy theories, right?
I mean, well, as I was screaming
about,
how are they
picking these dates?
I don't know. It's all random. It's, you know, 2 weeks to slow the curve and to give hospital emergency rooms a break. Look, the Rose Bowl was 2 weeks ago. It was in a packed 100,000 seat Rose Bowl stadium filled to the brim with folks, many maskless. What happened? I mean, everything was fine. Why did we even cancel? Why did we cancel? There's nothing more outdoors than the Rose Bowl in terms of stadiums. Why did we cancel it last year? What science was that? I mean, what science? Same science that banned Tin Horn Flats from serving out on the patio? It's insane. Look, it's a very dangerous time where the government can not use data to make decrees and then shut down businesses and shut down sporting events, not based on any data.
And I don't understand why we allow that. I don't understand, number one, I said it till I'm blue in the face, this COVID constitution where you're allowed to just believe something or have a untested decree and this perpetual state of emergency that allows for what would normally never be countenanced. And then there's the question you always, I'm on that end, you're on the other end. Why are people allowing this to happen? Why do people agree to this? Why do people say this is something that's okay? Right? I mean, you put in more colorful.
Yeah,
language.
They're pussies. No, here's what I've said it once, I'll say it again. The overwhelming number of voters in California are Democratic, and Gavin Newsom won in a landslide. So it takes somebody with some integrity, somebody like yourself, Mark, to say, I am in this man's party, but I do not condone or agree with what his policies are. Most people go, I voted for that guy. He's in my party, and I will somehow make this work in my mind. I will look the other way, or I will join him in his attempts to close down schools or outdoor businesses or stadiums or whatever that is, just to justify their vote. It takes a lot for the average person to go, I voted for that guy and I don't like what he's doing, which then makes you sort of culpable. It's like, well, I helped get this guy into this place where he could make horrible policies. Maybe I should think about that. Most people don't want to go there. And there's a few people that are intellectually honest who can think in two different ways. I voted for that guy, or he's in my party, and I also disagree with many of his policies.
Well, that's why I thought that this op-ed piece by Gary, how many is it? Six former medical advisors, including somebody we've talked about before, the author of the Why I Only Want to Live to 75, Ezekiel Emanuel, I think is his name. And they've talked about, look, there's got to be a shift here. We got to come to grips with what the reality is. And we're not dealing with the reality. It's almost as if we've picked a side, left versus right, or Democrat versus Republican, and we're not going to move from that side. We just refuse to move, because that would mean, I guess, building on your argument, it would mean that we have to admit that we were wrong, or that we got hoodwinked, or that this is something that that we talked about that just isn't possible. I mean, is there anybody now who thinks that when the current president says we're going to beat this virus, or I think eradicate this virus, anybody that believes at this point, 20 months in, that we're going to eradicate this virus?
No, and also the compliance for a lot of this stuff is very soft. I there is a vax mandate card check in Los Angeles and restaurants and so on and so forth. I haven't noticed almost any application of that. I went to the Supercuts about 45 minutes ago, and the woman said to me as I was walking in, she said, do you have your vax card? And I said, oh, no, but I think I have a picture of it in my phone somewhere. And she went, oh, I believe you. And I sat down and got my hair cut. Like, I went into a sushi restaurant the other week. Same difference. You know, just do you have? Yeah, okay, go ahead. I mean, they're literally just sleepwalking through the motions for this mandate. The compliance is little to none. I've seen no vigorous, you know, we're talking about SoFi Stadium. SoFi Stadium, you just walk through, you hold up, you don't even have to hold up your phone. You could hold up a flip-flop and the guy just...
You don't even have to do this.
You don't have to turn it on. If you took a flip-flop and you cut it into the shape of an iPhone and you just held it up as you walk, they just wave you right past. So you've lost the citizens. You know what I mean? Like, they are saying we're not in fear of this, because if you are in fear, you act as if.
Well, right. And if you are in fear, you're going to get somebody like that that woman that went viral on the jet, who was had to get carried off, basically, for hassling the guy who was eating and had his mask down or something. I mean, and then I've been wondering for the last 2 days whether that meme that you tweeted was real or whether it was sarcastic.
Where, I don't know.
That it just tickles me every time I think about it.
Well, I mean, you think about, you know, okay, you need to wear a mask for a Zoom meeting. All right, that sounds insane. But then you see footage, and I'm curious what you think of this. You see footage of Joe Biden alone on the beach playing with his dog wearing a mask. Now, there's two heads on that. One is, it's obviously it's all for show. He's quadruple vaxxed, and it's a paper mask, which doesn't do anything for Omicron. And they've now, even the maskers have taken their foot off the fucking accelerator for 10 minutes and went, oh, maybe with the new variant, whatever. But one head on it is he is sending a message showing people, as an example, you need to wear a face mask. On the other hand, he's doing it in a very non-scientific way that doesn't make any sense at all, which sends a different message. So I think the problem with a lot of these guys is, you know, they stand there masked up behind so-and-so while they're talking at the podium, and then they go up and they take the mask off. You cannot send all this crazy mixed messages. You just can't keep pushing it out there. You can't keep explaining that you should wear a mask when you're alone when it doesn't make sense, that you know, you shouldn't have anyone over to the house, or we need for Thanksgiving, or we should close the school down. You've lost the attention of the people. I think that's what we're experiencing. What I experienced at Supercuts was a person who worked at Supercuts who didn't give a shit. Same person would have given a shit 18 months ago.
Yeah, well, part of what you're seeing now, I think it's becoming somewhat accepted finally in the medical community, is this variant is highly transmissible. but is not as virulent. And, you know, by the way, we talked about this. You and I talked about this when South Africa started revealing their data and where this originated from. And so it looked like, yes, you were going to have these rapidly exponential growth in cases, but you weren't going to have the same death and hospitalization kind of growth. It wasn't going to track the way it did 18 months ago. Well, what does that mean? You know, people who have been screaming, like the Barrington Declaration scientists, that this is what viruses do. This is how viruses, you know, a virus is, it reminds me, a tiger is going to be a tiger. A virus is going to be a virus. That's by definition.
So
how are we still here talking about this in January of 2022?
Because the people who like the power want it. They got a little taste of that, and they like it. They're hanging on to it. So what's your prediction for the Supreme Court? You figure the one that's taking federal money, that'll go through?
Federal money, I think, will be probably will be okay, and the other is going to be enjoined. In fact, they were suggesting or talking a little bit, I don't know, obviously I've been talking to you, but there was a suggestion also of the Supreme Court imposing what's called an administrative stay, meaning they're not going to let it go into effect on, what was it, Gary, January 10th.
Monday.
So what they were going to do is, and I think they even asked the Solicitor General, what's your position on an administrative stay, which would mean basically that it can't go forward. We're going to call halt to this while we decide it. And I think that's what's going to happen. You're going to just see them say, basically, this is a judicial timeout until we sort through this and try to make some sense of what appears to be some contrasting and real issues. I mean, there are, whether you like it or not on the left, there are real the separation of powers issues. There are real constitutional issues, and it would be nice to at least have some recognition of that, I think, rather than just say, you know, the headline will always be conservative court falls in line with Republicans who, you know, sued to vacate the mandate. Well, okay, that may be true. However, look at what the issues were when they're saying, should there have been congressional action before the executive just took the action here? And I think that's one of the reasons that, and, you know, then you ask the next question, if they counted the votes, didn't think they could get this through Congress, and that's why it was initially done by executive action through OSHA as opposed to going to Congress, which, by the way, at least until next November, the Democrats still hold both houses. So why didn't they go to Congress in the first place and get it done?
Well, now turning the page to Ghislaine Maxwell in that case and the breaking news out of that. I know you have thoughts about that case.
I have quite a few thoughts on that. I've been in this situation more than a handful of times. And when I say this situation, what I'll set it up for those who aren't in the weeds on it, but she was convicted of 5 of 6 counts, I believe, shortly after the verdict. But obviously, before she's been sentenced and before there was any motion for new trial filed by the defense, one of the jurors went on a British interview, a British-based paper. Gary knows.
The Independent.
Yesterday on this. The Independent. And said that that a number of the jurors were bothered. And remember, the defense in this case basically pointed out, starting in the opening statements, look, you've got 4 accusers that were picked by the prosecution. These 4 accusers had made statements that basically did not implicate Ms. Maxwell until Mr. Epstein died. Once Mr. Epstein died, there was an Epstein kind of defense fund, which they, all 4 of these people, cashed checks from. And then they made statements that were at least refreshed or different than what they had said in real time going back various times. Okay. So you have that kind of, that was the defense. And the defense also called expert and suggested that a number of these memories would be suspect due to the passage of time. So that was a central part of the defense. Fast forward, she gets convicted. They were out for a period of time. It was not a quick deliberation. And this juror now says, hey, you know, I kind of steered this conviction. And the way I steered this conviction was I told them about my own sexual abuse and how my memory was, you know, suspect, or maybe that's the wrong term, but my memory was imperfect. And that had a great effect on not only the other jurors, but one juror in particular who also then cited his sexual abuse experience. And that helped them fill in the blanks or the doubts, dispel the doubts that they had about convicting her. Now you say to yourself, well, isn't that the what a jury is supposed to do? They're supposed to deliberate. We bring people from the community, use common sense. Well, there's the reason that we have a juror questionnaire. The juror questionnaire, especially in high profile cases, and I've been using the term stealth juror for almost 20 years now, is you ask specific questions because you don't want a juror going back there who becomes an advocate for the prosecution. That's not a juror's job. The juror is supposed to be a judge of the facts and take whatever the judge of the law gives them and apply that law to the facts. They're not supposed to be back there advocating for the prosecution to supply information that was not tested in the courtroom. So this juror, apparently on the questionnaire, although giving him the benefit of the doubt, nobody's released it yet, the questionnaire itself, but it's apparent that from the writings of the prosecution to the judge, that this was not disclosed. Well, that's more than troublesome. I mean, you're talking about somebody who's been in custody for going on, I don't know, 20
months
or so. This
is the prosecution to the judge or the defense to the judge?
Prosecution wrote the letter to the judge to get in front of it, which is stunning to me.
Yeah,
which is stunning. Because it's usually, yeah, by the way, if I had seen this and this was one of the jurors,
just picture the guy with a 30 pound cat.
Yeah.
40.
Can you imagine? This, I'm going to betray my own biases. This guy is not a defense juror in this case. Okay. There's no way, no how.
So why does the prosecution, I know you said get in front of it. How does that strategy work?
Well, they've asked for a hearing a month out, and they want to not allow basically anybody to contact the juror in the interim. And I think they're probably rightfully worried that there's a recent case that says that this goes directly to the integrity of the verdict. The Scott Peterson case, as you know, there's a current order to show cause being litigated in California by the trial court for a juror who doesn't even have the same fact pattern as this. In this sense, this juror is now talking about how he used his experience.
Mark's actually so animated he's punching the microphone.
Because it just drives me crazy. It's like you spent, can you imagine if you're both the prosecution and the defense and the judge, you've spent all of this time trying to get this case to trial, to get it to a verdict of some kind, and then this comes out?
Well,
it's astonishing.
So we haven't established it. First, I have a side question. If Epstein wasn't murdered or didn't kill himself, would we be having the Maxwell trial? Or did it just shift from him to her?
Yeah, the cynic in me says no, you would not. That the idea of trying her with him made very little sense from a prosecutorial standpoint. You might have, if he had been convicted and if the evidence had come out at his trial differently than what had been known. But remember, much of the Maxwell evidence, if you believe the defense, was developed after his death. So after Epstein died, then Maxwell evidence incriminating Maxwell was developed.
Well, they would have gotten her to flip on him, right? If correct. He went to trial. So
correct. I mean, that would have.
All her jeopardy is because he's dead, essentially.
Well, it sure looks like it. And then there's also the question, you know, you've got the trial judge has been appointed to the circuit court. So it was very interesting, at least for inside baseball, to see whether she expedites a ruling or a hearing so that she can move on and get to the circuit court, because there are vacancies there. And obviously it's helpful to have a full roster on the circuit court, or whether she decides, no, she's not going to dump this on somebody else. Those are parts of the thought processes that all judges go through. They don't want to leave another mess to somebody else to clean up. So what do you do in that case?
Well, so let me just be clear. If you were doing jury selection and they were filling out paperwork, you would specifically ask, were you ever the victim of molestation or sexual abuse?
Absolutely. Sexual harassment, sexual abuse, molestation. Do you know somebody who has somebody close to you?
That would almost automatically eliminate them if you were doing jury selection?
Well, it depends. If it's somebody... If the way they answer the question, if they say that I know somebody who was accused, falsely accused, no, I wouldn't eliminate. Then you've got somebody who can understand that accusations right. can be false. If you've got somebody who says, I was the subject, myself was the subject of sexual abuse. I've tried. I can't tell you how many cases involving sexual abuse. And it's the one area that I have found, even more so than murder cases, where jurors, it cuts across wide cross sections of the demographic. It really does. You eliminate quite a few jurors because they just admit they can't be fair if they're being honest.
So what's your prediction with this case?
I don't see how unless there's some facts that we don't know yet, it appears to me that this verdict is in doubt. I know I read an article this morning where there are a lot of people who I respect who are legal commentators and were saying, no, they don't think this is going to happen. I'm telling you, I have won this issue with worse fact patterns than this. This may be one of the best fact patterns I've seen in this term. I want to kind of emphasize why. It's not disclosed on the questionnaire, and then it's compounded by the fact that the person is saying there were people who had real doubts. I supplied them with reasons to assuage their doubt so that they could be comfortable voting guilty based on evidence which came into that jury deliberation room, which the defense and the prosecution had no ability to cross-examine or test. That's a real problem.
So you think this is going to be retried?
Yeah, I do. I think it's going to be retried. I just don't see how. I mean, it's whether it's going to happen at the trial court level or whether it's going to happen at the circuit court level. I mean, this would seem to me to be a real problem. And by the way, obviously the prosecution thinks it's a real problem, and hats off, a hat tip to the prosecution for getting in front of it and writing a letter to the judge and saying we need a hearing. I mean, obviously the defense came back and the defense says, we don't need no stinking hearing. We want to get this reversed now rather than have to waste a lot of resources or go up to or have this hearing or anything else. I mean, you could expedite it, bring that juror in, have him testify, but they also, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, appointed a lawyer for him as well. So you may also have very similar, once again, to the Peterson case, where in the Peterson case, the strawberry shortcake had one lawyer, maybe a second lawyer, and now supposedly is invoking the fifth.
Was that his mistress?
No, that was the juror.
Oh, strawberry shortcake.
Strawberry shortcake.
Did, yeah. What are the instructions to the jurors after they render a verdict?
Well, it used to be in the Ninth that they restricted, you couldn't talk, you couldn't do this, and then that was declared unconstitutional. Now, there's no restriction that I'm aware of that was that you could not talk to the press. There are, in other circuits, restrictions against talking to the jurors, meaning I wanted specifically in one case that ended up getting reversed, one of the ones I was thinking of, they had a extrajudicial communication with a prosecutor from another agency. I wanted to interview that juror. I was not allowed to under the local rules in that particular circuit. So it varies to some degree.
In the turnabout is fair play, or basically the same thing in the other direction. And I don't know how this one played out, but some years after the OJ trial, they interviewed famously one of these semi-elderly black women who was a juror, and she just went, it was payback time for Rodney King, essentially. I mean, she just said it flat out. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
I've heard it. In fact, it's funny you mentioned that, because I watched the other day, I binge watched the TV series,
right?
For People a completely different OJ reason.
But isn't that the same thing in a different direction?
But the one thing, there's two things that can't be appealed in the criminal justice system. One is the pardon power, and the other is a not guilty. So if a juror got on there and did the same thing, you had a stealth juror in the other direction. And I've had that also. I had a case in downtown L.A. I won't give the particulars about it, but it was 11-1 for guilt on about 50 some odd counts. And the judge called us up and afterwards and declared the mistrial and said to me rather pointedly, and I have a great deal of respect for him, he says, I don't think that was based on the evidence. And I think he was probably right. I won't tell you why I think this juror held out, but it probably wasn't based on the evidence.
So you won the case based on the one that was holding out, and maybe it wasn't all evidence-based.
Correct. I think that's a fair statement. On occasion, there are benefits.
Hey, Gary, I want to. I'll buy you a little time with a Geico read, but I was on the January 6th subject's been making the rounds, dominating the news as we record this. I think it was yesterday. Wait a minute, this is coming out today, right?
Yeah, this comes out tomorrow, but we record Friday,
yesterday. Right. And there's a lot of talk, and that story of the one big guy with the MAGA hat who's agitating for everyone to go up to the...
Ray something.
Yeah, and the sort of suspicious circumstances with that guy, how he fell off the FBI's 20 most wanted list, and how come we don't know who that guy is, even though we know his name. And there's plenty of footage of him saying, we got to march to the Capitol and you come with me and it's that way and everyone go and let's get in there. Now,
Ray Epps.
Ray Epps.
But by the way, while you're looking at that, also pull up. Also, I meant to send you this, Gary, the Tucker Carlson, Ted Cruz encounter yesterday.
Yeah, that was a good one. So obviously in a world where they're going after every human being that had anything to do with anything in that day, even remotely, and nobody shot anybody, or at least no MAGA people shot anybody, and there's not a lot of weapons or violence. There's some. But there's not a lot of meat on that bone. They're really going after instigators and agitators and people who were saying march and go and take it. Why is this guy off the list? And it seems pretty apparent to everybody that he was an FBI guy who was agitating, just like the Gretchen Whitmore case where they found out the governor of Michigan, where they found out in her plot, her kidnapping plot, half the guys involved with that were informants for the FBI, which sort of doesn't make it not true, but it sort of makes you wonder a little about government involvement. And sort of, it's a little bit of black ops shit. Like, really? Like, most Americans would never think that the FBI would plant guys in a crowd and have them agitate to go riot, for instance. But apparently, that's what this guy was, because that's the only explanation I can think of as to why his name never comes up and no one's looking for him when there's tons of footage of him. But we can...
That's a good tease, because I want to respond to
tease that.
Okay.
What are you looking for?
I'm still confused what you want on that subject.
Just some footage of him sort of screaming and yelling. And now there's a second guy who was up on the scaffolding with a bullhorn, and he's directing everybody, and no one knows who that guy is either. And that'll lead us into our Tucker Ted Cruz thing. First, there's Geico. Do you own, do you rent your home? Well, sure you do. You do one or the other, and you work hard too. So let's make it easy on you. Let's have you bundle those policies with Geico. Take your automotive policy and bundle it up with your homeowner's or renter's insurance. And it is just that easy. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could be saving when you get your bundle working at Geico. That is at geico.com and get your bundle on. Yeah, the Ted Cruz, Tucker Carlson thing was interesting. But I think a good example of when you interview somebody and you don't believe what they're saying, don't just nod your head. Call them out on it, even if
that's
they're
why
on
I
your
wanted,
own side.
That's why I wanted to play it. I thought it was it's an interesting, no matter who you are and what your political belief is. By the way, I used to love January 6th because it was Armenian Christmas. Right? it's been Armenian Christmas has been all usurped. But eradicated here.
Yeah.
It's been usurped in the diaspora. But if Gary's got it, it's really quite a exchange.
I can give you some of the nuts and bolts while Gary is looking.
Okay.
Ted Cruz called the rioters / insurrectionists. He called them terrorists, called them dangerous terrorists, and said it a few times. And then Tucker Carlson took umbrage with it because Tucker said, you can't call these guys terrorists. A, they're not terrorists. And B, you're just sort of playing into the hand of the media and everyone and Nancy Pelosi and everyone else by labeling them terrorists. Why are you doing this? And so Ted Cruz, who I've interviewed, who's a very bright guy.
Incredibly bright, which makes him incredibly dangerous.
Right. And so he heard that and he texted Tucker and invited himself on the show the next day to explain himself. And as he was saying to Tucker, I called them terrorists, but I call everyone who assaults a cop a terrorist. And that's just the vernacular that I use. So I may have made a mistake in calling everyone a terrorist, but that's just the language I use. And then Tucker did what all journalists should do. Like when you're interviewing Kamala Harris and you're asking her about the supply chain or have you been to Mexico, don't just sit there and nod your head while she spits out bloviating garbage. Follow up. So Ted says, that was my mistake. I call everyone who puts their hands on a cop, a terrorist. Tucker goes, I don't believe you. You're lying. You and rightfully so. He goes, Ted, nobody chooses their words more carefully than you. You're very careful in your word selection. You wouldn't do that just sort of by happenstance. You're a guy who shows up. You have a very strong legal background and you're a bit of a wordsmith. So nobody believes that you just mistakenly or offhandedly called somebody something when you're very precise with your language. And he just said he didn't believe him.
It was something. Gary, did you find it? Because I was going to comment about it also.
I have it here. I can play it from the top, and we can just call your own out. I haven't had a chance to review the whole thing.
Okay.
Senator Cruz was game enough to come on tonight. We appreciate that. He joins us now. Senator, thanks so much for coming on. So I guess what I mean, there are a lot of dumb people in the Congress. You're not one of them. I think you're smarter than I am. And you never use words carelessly. And yet you called this a terror attack when by no definition was it a terror attack. That's a lie. You told that lie on purpose. And I'm wondering why you did.
Well, Tucker, thank you for having me on. When you aired your episode last night, I sent you a text shortly thereafter and said, listen, I'd like to go on because the way I phrased things yesterday, it was sloppy and it was frankly dumb. And
I don't buy that. Whoa, 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 whoa. Look, I've known you a long time since before you went to the Senate. You were a Supreme Court contender. You take words as seriously as any man who's ever served in the Senate. And every word you repeated that phrase. I do not believe that you used that accidentally. I just don't.
So, Tucker, as a result of my sloppy phrasing, it's caused a lot of people to misunderstand what I meant. Let me tell you what I meant to say. What I was referring to are the limited number of people who engaged in violent attacks against police officers. And I think you and I both agree that if you assault a police officer, you should go to jail. That's who I was talking about. And the reason the phrasing was sloppy is I have talked dozens, if not hundreds of times. I've drawn a distinction. I wasn't saying that the thousands of peaceful protesters supporting Donald Trump are somehow terrorists. I wasn't saying the millions of patriots across the country supporting President Trump are terrorists. And that's what a lot of people have misunderstood that comment.
Wait a second, but hold on. What you just said doesn't make sense. So if somebody assaults a cop, he should be charged and go to jail. I couldn't agree more. We have said that for years. But that person's still not a terrorist. How many people have been charged with terrorism on January 6th? Like, why'd you use that word? You're playing into the other side's characterization that, as Joe Kent just explained, allows them to define an entire population as foreign combatants. And you know that. So why'd you do it?
So Tucker, let me answer you directly. The reason I use that word.
Exactly. And he wasn't letting him off the hook. That's what I mean. You got to give him credit. It's a good cross-examination. I probably would have asked a couple more questions about, but by the way, were you worried, and is the reason you used that language because you were worried that you at some point were in the crosshairs of some investigation because of your inflammatory remarks on the 6th? And were you trying to distance yourself? As Tucker just said, this is a guy who is highly educated, even though he plays this kind of bumpkin from Texas to a fairly well. But the highly educated, highly skilled, knows the law inside out, and probably at some level is thinking, you know, I've got to distance myself from what I was saying before because that is not over yet.
Well, I always like to say it's like when Fauci and they were asking him about natural immunity and he was going, I got to look into that. You know, it's look, when you take really, really bright people and they say things that don't make sense, you have to look at what's motivating them. Skillful wordsmiths don't get super sloppy and lackadaisical with phraseology just all of a sudden. And that's basically what Tucker's saying. You don't do this. This doesn't fit your pattern. This isn't who you are. And why did you do it? And don't give me the I was lazy and sloppy, because you're not lazy and sloppy.
And then there was the I saw commentary today that people are saying, well, they're both talking about or positioning themselves to run for president in 2024. So
really,
that's one. There's a constituency who believes it was Tucker trying to take out Cruz
I know Tucker pretty well. He is not one to be the president. I mean, his schedule is. His lifestyle, I should say, is insane. He literally has no TV in his he sleeps with his wife and his dog in the guest house of their property. They have no TV set. He gets up in the morning and pees on a bush. outside, literally. Then he takes an outdoor shower. Then he sits in a sauna for an hour. Then he composes his monologue. And then he rides his bicycle in flip-flops to the studio, which is near his house, which is undisclosed. I've been there, but you from the outside.
They blindfold you and twirl you around before they take you there.
It looks like a sleepy beachside village in a tourist town. It's nothing like what anyone thinks. His schedules, I mean, his lifestyle's insane. He literally doesn't turn on it. He doesn't own a TV set. It's a bizarre. It is so different than what you would ever imagine or expect. The thing about Tucker's, he just has a strong intellectual honesty. People are like, fuck that guy, or that guy's hateful, or I disagree with him. You may, and he may be wrong about certain things, but he believes everything he says. That's who he is.
You know, something that was interesting to me when I was reading about him was he has I don't know if affinity is too strong, but he respects Rachel Maddow, who is obviously a competitor on a different network, and respects the way she crafts her kind of monologue arguments and watches her. And I don't think he was blowing smoke. I think he recognized that somebody who had a completely different ideological viewpoint was able to craft, you know, I've often said about her that she would have made a very good lawyer in terms of her ability to put together arguments, persuasion, weave in humor, things like that, which is something he obviously values as well, because he watches her, admires her, and I don't know if it's reciprocal. I've never read whether she watches him as well.
Yeah. Well, she might, but I don't think she's going to say it into a hot mic. He also he thinks of himself as a writer. He does not think of himself as a, you know, newscaster or political personality. He literally thinks himself as a writer. He sits and writes his show out every day, just sits alone in a sauna. All right, we have the Ray Epps minute and 17 second video. And I'm curious. I know I've brought it up before, but why are we not looking for this guy? And why don't they care about this guy?
In fact, tomorrow, I don't even like to say it because I'll be arrested.
Well, let's not say it.
We need to go. I'll say it.
All right.
We need to go in to the Capitol.
Let's go!
So I'm going to put it out there. I'm probably going to go to jail tomorrow. We need to go into the Capitol. Into the Capitol.
Going up to the fence of the Capitol now. So, all right.
So, I'll tell you, I have a couple of reactions to this.
Yes.
Look, there are enough lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, involved in these cases that my guess is somebody has made either a discovery request or has made some kind of a informal request vis-a-vis who this guy is, whether he's being prosecuted, whether he's cooperating. I mean, it's just as likely, I suppose, based on my experience, that you could see somebody like this, and the reason that you may not hear anything about him is that he is cooperating. I mean, that's entirely possible. I wouldn't put it past. And when I say cooperating, then the question goes to for you, or for your question is, was he cooperating before? Was he a Fed as the people were yelling, or did he get arrested at some point and then immediately cooperate, and they've kept him out of the public view while he cooperates? If that's the case, then hypothetically or conceivably, you could think that he had a great deal of information that was helpful, and that's why they've kept him out of view so far.
He does not appear to be incarcerated with any of the people that were incarcerated.
No, he's not. Correct. And if we remember back to one of the earlier times we talked about this story, there was a time where he appeared on the FBI's most wanted list, or maybe the one that was specific to the insurrection. I believe he was number 13. And then a few months later, all the government websites wiped every mention of him.
So it seems, well, it also seems like they might want to address it if this guy keeps popping up on Tucker Carlson and people on the right side of the aisle are going, who is this guy and how come we don't hear anything from him? Why not just say, oh, we got him. We're talking to him. I would have never thought this way if I didn't hear about the old Gretchen Whitmer thing. It seems to me like he was a plant. The guy standing next to him seemed to understand when he started yelling Fed immediately that this guy was an agitator that was inserted into this crowd.
My father, 40 years ago, as I was just a guy in law school, used to always say about the federal law enforcement, he says, the feds never bring a criminal case unless they've got a wiretap or a snitch or both.
Do they need here's why I think it's a little dubious, this notion that he's got information. What information? Nobody else is rolling over. I've not heard any other person providing information. You know, it seems like he just showed up and marched in.
He is the chapter leader of the local Oath Keepers organization where he lives in Arizona. So maybe they're asking him to roll on members of his organization. That's purely my thing.
Could be. The other
pure speculation, but it would not, you know,
the other very is learning. The very interesting, another part of this that's kind of interesting is we forget all about the pipe bombs. Remember all the pipe bombs that were being planted?
Yeah, it just came out yesterday that the vice president was apparently at the DNC when the pipe bomb was found.
Who planted the pipe bombs? Where's the pipe bomb person? They have...
They've got that kind of grainy video.
Video of the pipe bomb person, but you would think in a world of Chewbacca guy with a Viking helmet and other people using, you know, folding chairs as weapons, the pipe bomb guy, that's a pipe bomb guy. Where's the pipe bomb guy? How come we don't have the pipe bomb guy? Then it makes you kind of wonder who was the pipe bomb guy. I don't want to sound like the tinfoil hat guy, but here's an interesting little mind experiment to go out on, Mark Garagos. If you are talking about the deadly insurrection that was January 6th, the armed, deadly insurrection that was January 6th, and you're using a lot of hyperbole, you're comparing it to Pearl Harbor, you're comparing it to 9/11, and you're calling it an armed, deadly insurrection. Well, nobody was armed traditionally. I mean, they didn't find firearms on anybody. And Ashley Babbitt's the only dead person. I mean, the only person that was killed during that, save ODing or an officer having a heart attack a day later in his office or whatever it is. How come pipe bombs are never woven into that discussion? How come if you're looking for some meat on the bone and you're trying to bolster your argument? Now, it didn't take place on the grounds of the Capitol, I think. I don't know where the pipe bombs were nearby.
Democratic National Committee.
Why not keep talking about there were pipe bombs? Like when somebody says, oh, it wasn't an armed insurrection. The guy had a fucking throw pillow and a Viking helmet. That's not armed. Well, they could be used as weapons. How come you don't go, what about the pipe bombs? What about the pipe bombs? They tried to blow up the DNC. What about the pipe bombs? How come no one brings up the pipe bombs when they're talking about all the doom and the gloom? Why are they ignoring the pipe bombs?
I have a theory, but I'm going to tease it for Tuesday Beyond, okay?
All right. We got
because I'm going to check it out. I'm going to check it out before I opine on it. I have a theory, but before I don't want to be tinfoil hat. I've got a theory.
I've not heard one human who was talking about democracy hanging by a thread and the worst since Pearl Harbor bring up pipe bombs. And it was planted at the DNC. So that's the real danger. That's the real potential for mayhem and death. Never bring it up. Curious.
Tuesday. Stay tuned.
All right.
Stay tuned.
You can go to adamcarolla.com for all the live shows, and you can check out our YouTube channel, youtube.com/reasonable doubt podcast. Only place to watch. Mark, what do you got?
Well, I'm pleased to announce that Gigi's at the V Palm Springs is featured on the cover of Palm Springs Life digital magazine today. And so stop by there. Also, we've got Casa Tropicana with Pierside restaurant downstairs. If you're in New York, go by one of the Provas. And if you're in downtown L.A., Tenney or Engine Company 28.
So until next time, Adam Kroll for Mark Garriga saying mahalo.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Tune in next Saturday for an all-new episode. This is Corolla Digital.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And together we host a weekly true crime podcast called The Prosecutors.
In every episode, we bring our unique perspective as full-time prosecutors to the most famous and debated true crime mysteries. Whether it's Maura Murray, Scott Peterson, or the Delphi murders, Brett and I dig deep to bring you details you won't hear anywhere else.
Our podcast is about more than just a story. We will walk you through the legal problems lurking behind every case, breaking down the complexities of the criminal justice system with humor and a personal touch. And it's not just true crime. We bring the same training and approach we've learned as prosecutors to classic mysteries like the Dyatlov Pass incident and the ghost ship Mary Celeste.
So if you're looking for a true crime podcast with a different point of view, The Prosecutors is the one for you. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.